Welcome to the Swapflix podcast. My name is Brandon Lede.
I'm Brittany Lombos.
I'm Hannah Rassinen.
And I'm James Cohn.
And we are recording in Hannah and James's living room in Mid-City, New Orleans. This is the podcast version of the movie review website,
Swapflix
Jazz Fest Edition.
Jazz Fest.
Get jazzed. We've done like musician episodes the past few Jazz Fests. I'm not even sure if this was planned or not, but we did a Led Zeppelin episode, then a Dolly Parton. And now we're caught up with Barbara.
One of the best musicians. I'm sorry, the best musician of all time.
Wow.
Bold claim.
Jesus, Brittany.
Putting a stake out early.
That is a bold stake.
Get your hot takes out early.
Best musician.
We are talking
alive
about
alive or dead.
There will never be an artist as great as Barbara.
She's an EGOT.
What I learned this episode was how to spell her name. That was my big revelation.
Right. It's not B-A...
It's not Barbara.
B-A. Yeah, it's Barbara.
She cut an A out of her name to streamline it.
Which Barbara. I was
I appreciate
typing
that.
Barbara into the search. And then I would write it and immediately think I did that wrong. And that is her correct name. So I was very happy. I learned to trust myself.
It almost reminds me of like, remember Barbar the elephant?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Barbar yes. and right. Barbara are more related than Barbara.
It just makes me want to call her Bra-Bra. But,
Bra-Bra.
the sonic landscape we've painted is fantastic.
It's beautiful outside. It's springtime in New Orleans. The city's waking up. We've done a lot of activities together recently. We went to French Quarter Fest. Jazz Fest is happening right now as you're listening to this. And Brittany and I went to hot dog drag bingo night. Just too many nouns in a row, but
yeah, almost. I could see how one could become a gambling addict after that. Bingo.
One too many gin and sodas and you're just be like drowning in bingo cards at Grand Prix every third Wednesday of the month.
Yeah. And some of the best hot dogs out there with some very adventurous toppings. Like you would just think there'd be like chili, but there was like chili and queso and then sauerkraut and then this homemade slaw with like celery salt and pick. It was just, I love the toppings.
Yeah.
That's a better experience than we had trying to go to Glizzy's on Saturday.
Glizzy's
and
by
they just
Papa.
Were not there.
No, they were not.
So we just drove right back home.
Yeah.
What a bummer.
We were talking about getting like a Glizzy's tracking app so you can know where they are at all times.
Yes,
yeah,
I need
please.
I'm invested in it as well. So.
Papa, tell me where you are.
Well, I could tell you where the drag queen CCV Dementh will sell you hot dogs once a month, which is that Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Drag bingo night.
Don't miss it.
It was a cultural event. We also went to another cultural event in Araby last weekend. We went and saw The People's Joker at the Zeitgeist Theater.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an illegal Batman movie that's been released under fair use parody law and kind of felt like a bootleg screening. I don't know if you've ever been to Zeitgeist before, but it's like almost like a warehouse space that has terrible sound quality, but also... In addition to that, was next door to a wedding venue this time, and constantly through the movie, you could hear pumping dance music just as loud as the dialogue
pulsating
of the film.
Pulsating through the walls.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got a sampling of Wobble kind of transfused with Back That Ass Up, which was, you know, fun to listen to.
It kind of made sense with this picture, which was a multimedia experience and has... several layers of texture in every shot, you know?
It didn't feel out of place in the situation we're in. Yeah.
I would agree, except for the, you know, maybe two or three scenes that were really quiet and supposed to be tender.
Emotional.
Right. And then it's silent, and then you hear, "What's up, everybody?" You know, that kind of didn't work as well.
The crowd was rowdy as well, which was good.
Yeah, there was an intense laugher.
Which made me miss some jokes. But, I mean, even, like, in a good presentation, like, high-quality presentation, you're going to laugh through some jokes and need to watch, like, a good comedy
second time
anyway.
And this was pretty, the pace was quick, too. Yeah. It was rapid fire, one after another.
So, the director, Vera Drew, was a editor for Tim and Eric, and also for Comedy Bang Bang. And she also is a lifelong Batman obsessive. So she made her own parody of the Todd Phillips movie Joker, where she plays the Joker and explains her come up through the comedy scene through that character, that arch villain, and also tells her like life story coming out as a trans woman and like basically like making a life on her own in the city outside of her homophobic household. And it is riotously funny. And like Hannah was just saying, like surprisingly tender in parts too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's a lot of laughs, but there were those great moments where the memories with her mother and things like that, like, were, I don't know. I got a little teary-eyed at some parts. But the humor was so smart in this movie, where it wasn't just, like, batshit crazy throughout the whole thing, which, like, when you look at it, it's, like, 20 different types of animation layered on each other, which is awesome. But, like, you think it's going to be crazy and quirky, but there was, like, a lot of smart humor, like, especially, like, these, like, name dropping, like, a lot of, like, folks who have been, like, canceled, I thought was like so bizarre, but the way it was done was so funny. Like, I don't know. I enjoyed it.
A lot of jabs at UCB. Citizens Brigade and their, like, comedy, like, structure climbing up into SNL.
Being a pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
The character of Lorne Michaels is wild. This
big, like, jiggly CGI Lorne Michaels, voiced by Maria Bamford.
So wild.
There's a lot of comedy scene in joking. Like, I'm sure a lot of, like, comic book obsessives would be picking apart all the Batman stuff.
Yeah.
But I was just, like, laughing at, like, there's a streaming app called Queebso, which is like a Quibi and CISO joke, which, I mean, probably 10 people in the country care about, but I thought it was very funny. And I know one of Brittany's favorite anti-comedy legends had a huge part in the movie.
Huge, yeah.
As like a comedy mentor for Vera Drew.
Yeah, Dave Liebehart is this, like, clown comedy, like, sensei who, like, helps Vera Drew, like, find her place in comedy.
Yeah.
And it's wild because he has this, like, smeared clown face and he looks so scary and is endearing and hilarious at the same time, which is kind of like the character he plays, like, in most of the, like, Tim and Eric skits that he gets, like, popped into. So it was cool seeing him there.
Yeah. Tons of, like, little cameos from a bunch of alt comedy people, and also a literal cameo, as in the app where you pay for a celebrity to be in your movie. We did not recognize the actor that was. I looked him up afterwards. It's the guy who played Arliss, and he was also in Batman Forever.
Oh, okay.
So it makes more sense in retrospect. It went way over my head in the theater.
Interesting, yeah. It went over my head, too.
Yeah.
Also funny that, like Tim Heidecker was, like, the Alex Jones voice on all these, like, news feeds that keep popping up. So that was really funny, too.
It's a very funny, very personal outsider art film that you should support if you have the opportunity to, whether or not it's in a bootleg environment that matches the bootleg aesthetics of the film.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a while since we've actually talked about this, so I have no idea what's going to come up. What have y'all been watching since the last time we did one of these roundups?
Me and Hanna went to the theater last weekend, and we saw Civil War, the new Alex Garland. What I've been enjoying about that film is more the conversation about it.
A petite civil war, if you will.
Yeah.
About the movie.
Just, you know, everyone has an opinion. It's been really fascinating to, like, kind of dig into how people sort of took the movie. And I don't know if you saw it.
I did. Yet.
I really enjoyed it. I think I struggle with what a lot of people seem to be struggling with, and with its overt political nature as, like, uses, like, a backdrop. I think a lot of people wanted it to be very, like, the MAGA Trump supporters versus, you know, the far left, and that's what the Civil War is. And the actual movie, it's like Texas and California have formed a coalition, and that's the, like, two state versus the rest of the country. And so I think some people were upset, like, that its politics weren't front and center. And as I've thought about the movie more, I think I actually do prefer that it didn't go into the really political on the nose stuff, because it is it's about something more interesting than that. So I don't know. I've enjoyed the discourse around it, and I think it's a very interesting, I mean, it is a violent, fucked up movie, but it's about, like, more about journalism and about fascism, not necessarily about, like, the current political climate in the United States necessarily, but all that stuff is kind of in the background. So I don't know. I enjoyed it, but the conversation around it has been interesting.
I think the conversation around it is infuriating. I think people are playing really dumb. Like, there's something about Alex Garland and Ruben Östlund in particular that just makes film nerds very insufferable. Like, they have this very jaded, like, I'm smarter than this person mm-hmm. attitude when, every time one of their movies comes out. And they're picking apart this movie, especially its world building, in this way that I think is really naive. Like, it's, like, dumber than the people actually commenting on it are, where it's like, oh, he plays both sides by referencing the Antifa massacre, but not saying which side did the massacring. And it's like, obviously, Antifa protesters were massacred by the right. government. Like, you're not that dumb.
Yeah.
Like, you know what he's trying to say. There's just like a mockery about his movies yeah. that bothers me.
I was apprehensive about this film because I thought it would be a us versus them, very specifically laid out kind of political movie. And it is very political, but it was, I feel like it allows the film to be about something bigger than yeah. like our how will MAGA patriots ruin the country. I mean, I just don't think that a movie about that kind of guessing is very interesting.
I was a little cynical about it in the beginning, and I know we talked about mm-hmm. it a lot after the movie, but like the marketing of the movie, it did make it seem like something that it's not. And I do think like releasing it in an election year with the marketing campaign that they had, and it is very successful. Apparently it was like the biggest opening weekend for an A24 movie ever. So I think it knew what it was very clever about what it was doing. It knew that there is this divide in America along political lines, and it was sort of playing into that to sell movie tickets. And then you get to the actual movie and it's more complicated than the black and white us versus them. But that's where I was a little cynical yeah. about it. Like, oh, you marketed this in a certain way to sell tickets, and the actual movie is not that, but for the better.
That's what A24 does though, right? Like
they're very good at marketing,
very challenging art, and they get butts and seats for it, which is yeah. like something most companies can't pull off anymore. Maybe it is a little disingenuous because it does like trick people into watching like horror movies they'll absolutely hate, you know, like I'm thinking of like The Witch and It Comes at Night and that kind of stuff. Right. Like they play this game very yeah. often. But like you're saying, the movie's actually more interesting than the marketing makes it look. But I don't think it sidesteps the politics really. Like
yeah.
the Nick Offerman presidential character in like a very early scene.
He's a fascist.
He's like a third term president who refuses to leave office, and he says, you know, we just had this great victory. Some are calling it the greatest victory in the history of victories. Like, which who's, is how who's
right,
it's verbal patterns that right. remind you of, you know? Yeah.
Well, and also the, like, targeting of American citizens.
Yeah.
And, you know, it would be dated if it was overtly, like, MAGA. I think talking more about fascism, that is the greater danger that American politics is flirting with. Not necessarily Trump himself, the idea that, you know, a lot of people are just kind of done with democracy as an idea.
Yeah.
So I think that was smart, because I think if you played more into the Trump stuff, then it becomes extremely dated
yeah.
in 5-10 years or whatever.
And also then you start to assign different parties within the movie to like current groups and organizations, and like once you start creating a one-to-one of like, oh well, these journalists represent this news station, it's like I think it just muddles the general dive into photojournalism and war photography and the ethics of war photography, especially when you're applying the same journalistic practices you use abroad in your own home. You know, if it was like he represents Trump and like these people are a stand-in for like Antifa, like the people going and trying to assassinate him. It's like you are pulling conclusions that aren't really necessary for the rest of the film.
And the movie's more interested in the journalists than that yeah. stuff. So it really doesn't need to sketch that out.
Right.
And there is like a generational divide in the journalists where it's like, there's this older guy who writes for the New York Times, and then mm-hmm. these younger people have, I want to say, more like a Vice News, like aggressive in your face style of journalism.
Yeah.
They kind of get off on the thrill of yeah. being in the action.
That's what's disturbing about it, is like people shutting off or like compartmentalizing their humanity to become these like very up close spectators to this violence. And, you know, someone's dying feet in front of you and your job is to not feel any emotions right. about that and just document it.
And to not intervene yeah. in any way.
It's chilling. Yeah. Like I found the movie very disturbing. It made me jump several times with like gunshots, which yeah. usually don't disturb me.
We saw it in the IMAX and it was yeah. loud. Yeah. Like every gunshot, you could feel it in your yeah. seat.
I really loved this movie because I loved photography when I was a kid and I really wanted to be a photojournalist. And I also love this book by Susan Sontag called Regarding the Pain of Others. And a lot of that book, it's a series of essays, and a lot of it is about how war photographs are used or photography of people who are suffering and how images are manipulated or even just used out of context for different reasons and how they can be used to justify yeah. political action of, I mean, basically whatever you want to do. And there are these fight scenes in the film that are contrasted with this really like poppy music. They show some of the photographs that a younger journalist takes of these really horrific, like people being shot or people splayed out kind of gasping for air. And there are these beautiful black and white photographs. And I mean, you can't help but see that they are beautiful. And it just horrified me to think that, to know this is a beautiful image and then to think, well, this is an image of someone, you know, bleeding out. And that's what we see all the time.
Yeah. And that's Kirsten Dunst's like, she's like the main photojournalist. That's her journey in the movie is like,
yeah,
like her humanity getting in the way of her job where she used to be able to ignore that stuff. And then like it kind of hits her like a wall a few times.
Yeah.
And she gets worse at her job because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the movie has anything more to say other than like, how fucking weird is it that people... can shut that part of themselves yeah. off, and it's like disturbing to watch it happen. And I think it's perfectly good for that. Like, I don't think yeah. it has to be everything to everyone. A lot of the complaints I've seen just feel like people made up what the movie was in their yeah. heads before they got to the theater and were mad when it was something else.
Yeah. I think another part of that, the idea that you can compartmentalize yourself. And also, she thinks that she's doing this to accomplish a greater good. Like, she, when she went overseas and took photographs, she hoped that that would be a warning to people that, you know, never let this happen. And it doesn't really do anything.
It's ineffectual.
Yeah. So not only have you kind of dehumanized yourself, but you don't know what, if that has helped or even if it's hurt. You know, because yeah. again, those images can be used to justify violent intervention.
And like James said earlier, like they're getting a thrill from it. Like,
yeah.
they might be saying all these things about like, oh, we're just sending the raw information and letting people decide for themselves. But we're watching them like smile and have a good time and like right. get off on the rush of it, too, which is like fucked up.
And I do think that's accurate. I mean, you talked about the Vice style of document. I'm going to go to the most fucked up place in the world and, you know, report back what it is. Like, you're getting a thrill out of it because then you can go back home to wherever you live and like yeah. there's something kind of gross about that the movie yeah, like you said, the Susan Sontag, like as I was watching it, I was like, oh, this makes me want to reread yeah. that Susan Sontag book, because all the stuff in this movie is talked about in that book in maybe more interesting detail, but it's good for what it is.
Yeah. I know this is a movie podcast, but it is a good book. So
yeah, if the themes of Civil yeah, War interest definitely. You, read the Susan Sontag essays because they're yeah. really good.
It's also very short. So it's
anyway. Well, Hannah, what else have you been watching besides watching Civil War with me?
Well, I really haven't been watching that many movies lately, but I have been trying to catch up on films that I feel like I should have already seen. And one of those is American Psycho. I had never watched this movie. It was directed by Mary Harron. I feel like most anybody listening to this will know what this it's Christian Bale. He's a middle. I can't remember what his actual title is, but every man that he works with has the exact same title. Works in he's a finance guy, like an assistant director of mergers and acquisitions or something like that. and he is a soulless shell of a person who has, he has a girlfriend, but he has no real identity beyond, you know, the apartment that he lives in and the various exercise, nutrition, and beauty routines he set for himself. And he just feels this gnawing emptiness that he tries to fill by killing people in horrific, violent displays. So I never watched this movie because it was very popular among film guys that I knew in middle school and high school.
Film bros.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
same.
It was always talked about as like this cool, like, oh, he's so crazy and cool. And I just really wasn't interested in watching that life being glamorized.
It's like the Fight Club effect, like right. Fight satire Club. Went yeah. over their heads.
Yeah. And
there was something
movie,
about that time period. Because we grew up right. in that, like, we were in high school when, yeah, everyone was into, like, American Psycho, Fight Club, but didn't get the satire
yeah.
part.
Yeah.
And I love this movie.
It's really
it's
funny.
It's great. It is, I mean, it is so funny. Christian Bale is fantastic.
Great Tom Cruise impression.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
And there's even, I mean, a lot of it is a, and it's based on the book by Bret Easton Ellis, and he writes a lot of just empty characters. I actually haven't read American Psycho, but I've read other books by him. So, yeah, so many people in this film are totally unlikable. But there are a few. There's one character played by Chloe Sevigny, who's this kind of naive secretary who actually has a little bit of humanity, and he can't kill her. He kind of lets her go. And then he has this moment of breaking down where he calls his lawyer and confesses to all of the murders that he's done. So I thought that there would be, it would just be all kind of satire, emptiness, nothingness. And it's really this thick shell around this very tender core inside of like desperately trying to find meaning and being totally unable to do it. So I don't know. This movie just really surprised me. I thought it was great. I would watch it many more times.
Yeah, almost too much of it is like wrapped up in my head with like other people's
right.
experiences with it, which is exactly what I was just saying. People were entering Civil War with like,
yeah.
You know, like extra textual conversations like affecting your viewing of the movie. I would have yeah. to go back and watch this because it's yeah. been so long.
Yeah, and I think I was kind of able to inoculate myself because I was just, I had such a thick like skin against it. I was so resistant to watching it. And then I just kind of refused to think about it when
yeah,
I was actually watching the movie.
I don't know if I would ever want to read the book just because yeah. I know, like I went into it, my preconceived notion. Like I know Bret Easton Ellis
right.
is like kind of, his politics really suck. Like I've seen him. He's like a, you know, conservative Trump supporter kind of dude, and to see him like write something like American Psycho and then turn into that
right
just made me not really, but I think the direction
mm-hmm.
is phenomenal, and Christian Bale's performance makes it a really fun watch. But again, I don't know if I want to read the book.
Yeah And it's directed by a woman. It was co-written by Mary Harron and another woman, Guinevere Turner. So it was not directed and written from this intensely male perspective. I think it still has a male perspective, but it's more nuanced than this like sick movie about you know, a fucked up film or
it could have went
guy.
Off the rails if,
yeah
you know, but I think they did a really good job with it, and it's yeah it's very entertaining.
I don't think I watched it since high school. Now that you mention it, all I remember is like there's a scene where, isn't he playing like Phil Collins? Like
Huey
really?
Lewis in the News.
Yes, Huey Lewis in the News. That's it. I couldn't think. There's like some band, like weird band. He was like playing out loud and
talking about how much he loves them and like what makes their art interesting
okay.
to him.
Oh my God! Yeah, because yeah. So I guess like not only is Huey Lewis in the News big and the Back to the Future movies, they exist in American Psycho
they
as well.
Were, yeah.
Wow.
They had an era, a reign.
Has anyone seen the sequel with Mila Kunis instead of Christian Bale?
No.
I've seen the cover though.
Yeah.
Where it's like her mouth, it's just the lips of a woman with like the a knife.
That can't be good, right?
I would watch it.
I can't conceive of it being good. No.
I think it's on Tubi.
I believe that.
That sounds like a Tubi original right there.
Well, Brittany, what have you been watching?
So I watched a movie that's been on, like, I always make, like, these cues on every single, like, movie app that I have. And I'm like, just watch your damn watch list, Brittany. And there's a movie that was on several watch lists for, like, years. And it's called Keeping the Faith. It's directed by Edward Norton. And it stars. Yeah.
Oh, I've heard of this.
It stars Edward Norton, Jenna Elfman, and Ben Stiller. And it kind of falls into, like, the rom-com category, which I normally like those movies.
Are they both priests?
So
I remember I saw this in theaters.
Oh! Yeah. So Ben Stiller is a rabbi. Yeah. Edward Norton's a priest.
Yes.
And they all were like childhood friends. So Edward Norton, yes. Ben Stiller, and Jenna Elfman like grew up and went to high school together and stuff. And then they went off like, you know, Ben Stiller went off to be a rabbi. Edward Norton went off to be a priest. Jenna Elfman is like this, you know, badass businesswoman.
And then they walk into a bar.
Right. And then she like goes to New York on like a business trip or something like that. Or she moves back for a job and she's like, oh, let's reconnect. And then they're like, oh my God, she's the coolest girl we ever met in our life. And they sort of become this weird thruple. But like Ben Stiller and her start to have this like little like relationship affair. And you know, Edward Norton, the priest, his character doesn't really like know about it, but he's falling in love with her too. It's weird. It's quirky. Didn't feel as rom-com as I thought it was going to be. Not a lot of rom, but more com. But it falls more into like hot priest movie category. Okay. Like Edward Norton is sort of like this thirst trap of a priest. And I think like if you're into that, you'll enjoy it.
So he's kind of like Christian Bale checking himself out in the mirror mid-sex. Like he's like shooting himself to be this hot guy.
So like he's kind of like
as the director.
Right.
I think it's more how like Edward Norton is, especially like in, I mean, this was made in like 2000. He was like a big hottie, right? So it's like him and the priest thing. I think like it was purposely done that way.
Yeah.
But he's not full of himself. He's just very quiet, which makes it even more intense, right? Where it's like, oh, I'm just this innocent priest guy that I think I like a lady.
It's crazy that we moms lived are in a world where Ed Norton was a heartthrob. Yeah.
Right.
I do remember that time period.
Yes. What? Fight Club days, I guess.
I guess so, yeah. Fight Club.
Yeah.
Yeah, he never went like the Jake Gyllenhaal route where he like bulked up to
right.
like live up to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he's always a sleek, slender
right.
Well, I guess, well, unfortunately, in American History X.
Oh, yeah.
He was pretty bulked up, but he was a neo-Nazi.
Yeah,
so
that kind of undercut the sexiness
yeah.
a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, his body looked great. He was right. very toned, but bad.
Just block out the tattoo portion right. of the screen
yeah,
with your hand.
Yeah. Leave all that out.
Oh, God. Well, he's, apparently he's a director, too. I had no idea.
I totally remember this movie. He just unlocked a memory within me. I
saw this in theaters
yeah.
with my mom. I remember.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice. Yeah, it's a pretty intense mom movie, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't remember there being a lot of like crisis of faith.
No.
Stuff.
You would think like, it was faith? So light.
Yeah, you would think it would be like deep discussions about like, well, I'm dedicated to God, but I also have this right. lust for this woman, and there's none of that yeah. from what I remember.
It feels like an episode of Sex and the City. If there was right. like, if they were the characters, like it just felt like
there's
light,
a hot
like,
priest episode of that show.
Oh yeah, there is. That's yeah. my favorite episode with Samantha and the Friar
Fleabag
Fuck.
Too.
Friar and Fleabag.
Right. Are they like comparing gods at all? Like, does the guy who gets the girl, does he have the better god? You know, or is
they just sort of
role does faith play in the film?
They sort of like the faith and keeping the faith.
Yeah,
is. I don't know. They kind of have this banter between each other and their friends. And it's just like, hey, we just yeah. have different religions, but we're buddies and we're doing our thing and
that's
we're committed.
Nice.
That's kind of what it comes off as.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Interesting.
I would love to see like Ingmar Bergman tackle the same, ooh. You know, fate. Oh, God, I love this woman, but I am dedicated to you. What
right.
will I do?
To my Lord.
Well, like the cover of it, it's three of them and she's in the middle. And I went in thinking like, oh, they're like a thruple and that would be kind of cool.
No,
that would be
no
cool.
design for living
yeah
here.
So
damn.
keeping the faith.
Very breezy rom-com, it Very. Sounds like.
A yeah. polytheistic relationship.
Ooh. Oh, there we go.
Polly's like underlined.
So, yeah, watch it.
Yeah.
Brandon, have you been watching anything light, as in keeping the faith?
Not exactly. But I got more sexual perversion we could talk about.
Ooh.
Uh-oh.
I have one last Overlook thing to report on, believe it or not. Every year at Overlook, they bring in Vinegar Syndrome has a table, and I always blind buy something just based on how cool the covers look.
Nice.
And I bought one this year called Singapore Sling, which is one of their newest releases. This is from 1990. It is a Greek exploitation film, and it starts with this kind of like noir protagonist who's like just drunk in the rain, mumbling about how he misses his dear Laura. So it's already like referencing the 40s Predinger film. And he's like looking for her, and he's like giving up and just drinking himself to death. But he does track down the last place Laura might have been, which is this mansion where these two women live. They end up being a mother-daughter duo. We first see them digging a grave in the same rainstorm, and then see them having incestuous sex with a strap-on, where one of them is pretending to be Laura, and they're doing like role play as her. Turns out they definitely killed her and buried her in the garden. And they also have a history of killing their servants and employees because they're, you know, they're wealthy, so they're depraved. So they live in this mansion, and the guy ends up showing up there, mumbling about this woman that they definitely killed. And they give him the same treatment they gave Laura. They strap him to a bed and just fuck him to death while like trying to suss out how he became suspicious of them, whether he's a cop, like whether or not they're actually going to get in trouble for this, or if he's just another plaything they can discard. So it's got this like kinky S&M vibe to it. The father figure that would be, you know, completing this like family is a mummy they keep in the attic that they also have sex with sometimes.
Wow.
The whole thing is shot in this black and white Universal monster movie kind of feel. Some of their sex toys are almost like Frankenstein electrical equipment. You don't really know what it does. It just lights up and they electrocute the guy with it. It is a high style BDSM chamber piece, part noir, part horror, part pornography. Like it really is just like a lot. I don't know much about the director. His name's Nico Nikolaitis, but I imagine Yorgos Lanthimos like came up watching his stuff. There's a little bit of Dogtooth in there and that incestuous closed off environment. And then also, you know, the like the fruit masturbation and Poor Things where you're like, how is she going to masturbate with an apple? You see it here.
Wow.
It's possible. There's documentation.
Wow.
There's like a lot going on in this movie. It has a very striking cover of like a woman's face with a ball gag, but the gag is an eyeball, and there's like chains going up and down the
cover. So that's obviously cover. Why you're like, yes, I need to buy this.
I have to
this.
See that. Yeah. And it lived up to that cover. I mean, it delivers on like the kink aspect, like rape fantasy stuff that like feels like you should not be watching it.
Sounds like a pervert's paradise.
It was great. I don't know that I've been that embarrassed by watching a movie that I loved instantly since we talked about The Skin I Live In, where I was like, oh, this is fantastic. I feel like a terrible person for loving it. So
that sounds interesting.
Man, that sounds like a movie night watch.
Yeah, it does.
If y'all are down for it, I would totally watch it again.
I mean, you have a Vinegar Syndrome copy, we kind of have to.
It looks beautiful.
Nice. Like, great.
Yeah, the cinematography is gorgeous, really crisp. And believe it or not, even though we are talking about Barbra Streisand, that will not be the last time that leather, kink, BDSM stuff comes up in this conversation.
It's not.
So stay on the hook for that and much more wholesome stuff in between. And all that's coming up to you
right now.
I got 36 expressions. Sweet as pie to tough as leather. And that's 6 expressions more than all them Barrymores put together. Instead of just kicking me, why don't they give me a lift? Well, it must be a plot, because they're scared that I got such a gift. Well, I'm miffed, because I'm the greatest star. I am by far. But no one knows it. Wait, they're gonna hear a voice. A silver flute. Ooh-hoo, ooh-hoo, belt cheer each two. Hey, that kid is terrific. When I expose it. Now, can't you see to look at me that I'm a natural Camille? As Camille, I just feel I've so much to offer. Hey, listen, kid, I know I'd be divine because I'm a natural coffer. Some ain't got it, not a lump. I'm a great big clump of talent left. They'll bend in half. Did you ever hear a story about the traveling salesman? 1,000 jokes stick around for the jokes. 1,000 faces. I reiterate, when you're gifted, then you're gifted. These are facts. I got no axe to grind. In all of the world so far, I'm the greatest star.
Okay, welcome to Babsapalooza.
Pew, 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 pew.
I have been wanting to do something with Barbra Streisand for a long, long time. She's, you know, everyone knows who Barbra Streisand is. She's a singer. She's a songwriter. She's an actress. She's a director. She's everything in the creative world. As one wonderful human being and an interior designer.
Go into that more. What do you mean by that?
I have a coffee table book that's Streisand's Eye for Design or something like that. And she kind of talks about like how she like went through her home. Like we'll have to talk about this later too.
I'm picturing like 30 Shades of Beige right now.
No. She's okay. She's very tasteful. Like she loves gold. She loves very decadent things and flowers, but she's like not distasteful with it. And like she has like an antique mall like in her basement. Like,
wow.
You know, Americana.
Sounds legit. Great. I'll buy it. Okay.
Yeah, she's talented. Talented. So a little history of Streisand, right? She was born in Brooklyn and in her teens, she went to Manhattan because she wanted to be a stage performer, right? And she started doing shows and then she would do singing performances at this club called like Bonsoir. And that's when someone saw her performing at the club singing and they're like, wow, this is like an amazingly talented young woman. Like, and from then she got booked on Broadway shows. And one of those shows was Funny Girl. And that's the movie that I selected for my Barbra Streisand choice. So she acted in Funny Girl on Broadway. And eventually, it became an actual film. And she reprised her role as Fanny Bryce in that film. And this is, like, what made her career take off a little bit. She won an Academy Award for her, like, debut movie as an actress, Insane. And then from there, like, there was just Streisand movie after Streisand movie after Streisand movie. Her heart belongs on, like, the theater stage. Like, she's very much, like, I don't want to lip sync over something for a song. I want to sing it live. I want to perform. I don't want to stop and go and stop and go. I want to just have this whole scene play out. So her stepping into film was a little different. I think, like, she initially just wanted to be, like, a classical singer that had some stage presence. So I think Funny Girl just really, like, transformed, like, what her career like what she expected her career to be. And then she would go on to do even more, right? She then became a director and then she became a producer and then she kind of really delved into the film world. So yeah, Funny Girl. Funny Girl is about Fanny Bryce. So Fanny Bryce is this vaudeville actress who's known as being this like wacky funny lady who like wasn't as pretty as a lot of the other women in these like Ziegfeld Follies shows and things like that. And I always thought it was interesting because Streisand also had the same issue when she was up and coming. Like, she's gorgeous.
That I need to pause there for a second. Almost every one of these movies we picked are about how she's not hot.
Yeah.
And I cannot suspend my disbelief.
Yeah,
she's incredibly hot.
She's beautiful, but a lot of
what's going on here?
Whenever there were reviews from her being on a stage show or on a movie, like they always talked about her nose.
Get
like,
the fuck out of here.
A lot of the reviews was like, her performance was great. Great to see a woman with a nose like that playing the leading woman in a film. And it just seems interesting because it's like Fanny Bryce kind of went through the same thing a little bit.
this is why we have like a hotness shortage right now, and all these like movie stars are so perfect. Like, we just talked about Nick Cage in Moonstruck and Valley Girl, how had these like beautifully fucked up teeth that made him like 10 times hotter.
Yeah.
Like, just having people redo their faces and like shave down every quality about themselves so they all look the same and perfect.
She never gave in, though.
It's bullshit.
No. She never had any plastic surgery. Yeah. I'm sure she's had a little like zhuzhing up, but
I will say Fanny Bryce is a legitimately funky looking woman.
Right.
And Barbra Streisand is pretty classically beautiful.
And she enters the movie, like the very first frame she's in, she like walks in front of a mirror. She's wearing this beautiful like leopard suit and sharp cat eye eyeliner on and looks in the mirror and says, "Hello, gorgeous." And I'm like, gorgeous. Yeah, you're right. You're fucking gorgeous. Yeah. And then the whole movie was about how that's like not true.
Mostly because of her nose, I think.
Mostly the women say she's not gorgeous,
right.
And every man around her you're incredible.
Maybe I'm playing into a stereotype here. I don't know.
I was reading, so not for this movie, but a review for another movie we're going to talk about, and the critic did bring up her looks in a negative way, saying
that's
she looked
crazy.
Like a raccoon or something.
What?
I'm
like, what? Like,
people are horrible to her.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Is she anti-Semitic? Is that like the start and end of it? I don't know.
I mean, I know raccoon.
Maybe.
All these critics are like,
I don't know if it was
a raccoon.
It was some sort of feral animal.
Well, that's horrible.
All these critics are probably dead by now, but like, if they're alive, I want to drive to their like house and like slit their tires.
That made it sound like Barbra had them killed, you know?
Well, she's like,
she has like a list.
Right
they
now.
May not have lived the night.
Ooh. So, yes, Funny Girl. So the film starts off, it's Fanny Bryce, and she's, like you said, she enters, she has this gorgeous, like, leopard coat on and hat, which is, I would die for this outfit. And she goes into a theater with her name literally in lights. It's, you know, Ziegfeld Follies, Fanny Bryce, and she goes in to this empty theater to prepare for a performance. And then she kind of sits down in the theater, and she's like, this is this. The only part of the theater I haven't seen is her being in the audience and looking at the stage. And then we have these like flashbacks to her as like a young girl before her career started off. And she worked at this like bar restaurant with her that her mother owned. And she wanted to be on stage and she wanted to be in vaudeville. But kind of like the ridiculousness of like, well, she wasn't pretty enough to be one of the pretty vaudeville girls. And she had no coordination at all. But she sort of like snuck her way onto this stage performance, being like, yeah, like your girls are roller skating. I can roller skate. And she could not roller skate. And it's an awesome scene. And it's hilarious. But she started to realize like, oh, she's hilarious. Like the audience loved it. And then she did this really great performance of, you know, I'd be blue over you.
Yeah. That was
and
a great scene.
So it's like, oh my God, she's hilarious and she could sing. So after the show ended up being really successful, she's backstage with her gals and Nick Arnstein comes. So he's this like dat Omar Sharif, this really handsome man who's like, you know, she's sort of like swooning over and he invites her to dinner and she sort of politely declines and she goes on to perform in Ziegfeld Follies and her debut performance is this like, you know, beautiful bride show where she shows up and she's like the main bride and she shoves a pillow underneath her dress to be the pregnant bride, which is the big goof, right? And it works, same thing. She's like creating this brand for herself as being this like funny lady and Nick Arnstein just keeps like sort of showing up at these performances and he's also a gambler and he lost like a shit ton of money gambling and he is going on like a boat, like sort of this transatlantic boat to basically gamble his money back on this boat. And she's like falling in love with him. And then she's also this like her career sort of shooting off. So she makes the decision to sort of like give that up and then jump on a couple of boats to get to him, which there's one of the best scenes and one of the most memorable songs is Don't Rain on My Parade.
Oh, you'd have to qualify that the best scene, the best song.
And the whole scene was shot in this train station, New Jersey, where it had been like out of use for years and years. And the caretaker of that train station was like, hey, they want to film a movie here. So I think he might have like popped up in the scene a little bit. He's just this like sweet old man. Ah. But I think just that scene was like $250,000 for them to shoot.
Whoa. It's a star-making scene,
but
though.
It's,
like, yeah.
It is. Yeah, it's so powerful. So that's kind of like the first half of the film. And then sort of the second half is, you know, her relation, less of her like career building, but more of her marriage to Nick Arnstein. So they, you know, are madly in love. She gets in the boat with him and, you know, her career starts to go off and he's like a professional gambler and he starts to lose money and he gets involved in shady deals and she keeps trying to like get him out of these things. And their marriage kind of starts to fall apart a little
bit. It's got like a macho pride that won't let him pay.
Yeah.
Won't let her pay for their bills.
Yeah. And then it ends. And like, so I have a lot of my favorite Barbara songs are in this movie. I love People. It's my favorite.
I don't like that song.
I love it.
What does that song mean? What is she talking about?
People need people, Brandon.
People need people.
The people who need
the most luckiest people
are the luckiest
in the world.
I think it's like the people who can acknowledge that they need community and are able to reach out to other people are lucky.
So people who don't need people actually do need people, but those people won't admit that they need people.
Exactly. We all need people.
You're not a people person, then.
Yeah, yeah. I hate people, so I don't get it.
But you need people.
Right.
You just won't acknowledge that you need people.
We all need people. But the end of this movie, the My Man song and her performance as it like, as the curtain sort of drops where it's like her sort of her last stage show and she, you know, her marriage has fallen apart, but she's still loves Nick Arnstein. I don't know. It's a beautiful ending. And the pace of this movie is so great because it starts off really strong. And then a lot of times, like there seems to be a slump in movies, like as we get to that halfway part, but there was so much drama with like her marriage that it made it spicy. And then we end on this like beautiful somber note.
I don't know.
I totally disagree.
Oh my God.
I'm sorry. I don't want to be the like.
No, it's okay.
Well, okay.
I'm not.
We love Barbara Streisand as a person, I think, or as a performer. The movies, I think, don't always live up to how talented she is.
I can maybe agree with that. No, my problem, like to your point, the rags to riches stuff worked so well for me. I'm like, yes, this is what it's about. And then when it goes into the, you know, Nick Arnstein, the gambling debts and like their relationship stuff in the second half, I didn't care.
Omar Sharif sucks in this movie. He's
he's
vacuum.
He's a drag, and I don't understand, like, why are you...
He has a very pretty smile.
And I think that's a recurring theme with a lot of the Barbara Streisand is, like, her biggest fault is that the wrong men fall in love with her.
Yeah.
That is a recurring thing. That, and this is, like, a quintessential example. Like, when it shifts into the relationship stuff, I could really care a lot. Like, when it's just her, like... In her career, like, yes, that's what I want. And then there's like a hard shift, like you said, halfway through the movie, where to me it just dragged.
Yeah,
I'm like, man, it's a 2.5 hour thing, and the last hour is just her and this guy who has gambling debt. Like,
but aren't her outfits great?
No doubt.
She is great.
Her like marriage outfits are like phenomenal.
Sure, yeah.
I guess it's compelling in that.
If there's anything redeeming.
I agree with you.
I guess it's compelling in that like you're basically like drop this loser the whole time. The same way that like if it's a slasher movie, you'd be like, get out of the house. Right. Like that's how it feels.
Yeah. And that is, I mean, the back half makes the point that her life is complicated, but she's a comedian and she kind of has to just perform through that. So I think it works in the last half, but I love like every ascension she makes in the first half is so exciting.
It is very strong.
The grape dresses, roller skating around, bumping into ladies, and then just like totally killing that performance. And then the bride scene is just gorgeous and she's so funny. I mean, I just was lapping all of that up.
But Omar Sharif, like, yeah. Oh my God. I've got a bunch of debts and I don't want you to pay for stuff.
Yeah.
Aye, man, you woman.
Right.
He was ashamed.
Yeah.
And Omar Sharif is like, I know he's a good actor and he's like a very attractive man, but his character in this is like just bunk. He just sucks. Like,
yeah. Dude. I just cared a lot more about her career. I know that that part of her life is significant. But
well, that's part of the story too. It's like yeah. She gives up her career
yeah.
for this
yeah.
man.
Don't rain on her parade.
I think the problem with this movie, if there is one, I mean, obviously a lot of people love this, but it just like came too late in the Hollywood like filmmaking cycle where, you know, this is late 60s.
68.
Yeah. It's very bloated for a Hollywood musical. Yeah. And like this old Hollywood style of filmmaking was just very creaky and like not very exciting. Like if you look back to 40s musicals, like the Busby Berkeley stuff, it's very quick. It's very snappy. The songs have those giant elaborate stage directions like in the pregnancy mm-hmm. bride scene that you were referring to, like that's absolutely gorgeous, but in a 40s movie you get that very quickly and then you go into like a bunch of comedy bits
yeah
and it's just like hit after hit after hit
yeah.
And this just feels like this like 3 hour drawn out dusty relic. Oof.
but the first hour and a half is kind of hit after hit after hit, and then they tack on
right
another hour of relationship stuff that I don't think really needed to be there.
And that's the kind of stuff that like new Hollywood people like came in and like, oh no, we're gonna make quick exciting films again that are a little more pared back.
Funny Lady,
maybe not, but if you think about it in the timeline though, like we just watched Ken Russell's The Boyfriend,
yeah, mm-hmm.
which came out just a few years after this and was basically like calling back nostalgically to this time in Hollywood's filmmaking. Like it's just like so late in the cycle that it's almost nostalgic kitsch, but it's not quite there yet.
But I think like it's also like biographical too,
yeah,
like it's a biopic, so and I think her Fanny Bryce's son-in-law was the producer for this too, so there was like a lot of
no, it's just never a good thing when like
I don't know, like part of me is like
the family has like final say on what's done, what has to be included. I don't know,
so I don't know, like part of me is like, was the it might have been like, it is obviously more somber than that like first half, but maybe that was the point of it, is
yeah,
that's just kind of what happened to her,
right?
And she was trying to juggle this like giant career while having this like leech of a man.
And I like that the movie has
and a baby.
You know in the very first scene she's talking, or not sorry, not the first scene, but when she first gets the telegram that she's gonna audition, she says, you know, like, this has all come to me so easily. I haven't suffered enough yet to get this. And she's like very young and kind of dramatic. But like part of the point of the movie is showing that her suffering came from a very different place. And it wasn't coming from her career. I mean, that may or may not be what Fanny Bryce's life was like. But I think that the relationship drama serves a purpose in the story. It's just a lot harder to watch, maybe like just not very energetic or interesting, but I don't think it's bad to have it in the movie.
So I'm gonna be very honest, I've watched this movie a bajillion times and normally like if I have it on like after she gets on the boat, that's when I'll start to multitask.
Yeah, yeah. Pull some laundry.
That's how I felt.
I don't hate it, but I think like, I really do like that second half. But it's like not, I get what y'all are saying. Like, it's not as exciting as those big and those wonderful musical numbers in like the first half too.
Yeah. Yeah. I had watched this movie a long time ago, but I never finished it. And I was kind of wondering why. And I finished it up until the boat scene. And then I stopped.
And that cutoff of Don't Rain on My Parade is such a great climax. Like, it just feels so good.
And that feels very, I wonder how it matches up with the Broadway production, because that feels like an act one ending. Yeah. Right, exactly. And then it's like, and that's a part of Broadway plays too. You have these two very different halves working together.
I just don't really have a stomach for like rich people problems. Like, oh, well, I have this big lucrative career, but my husband, he's rich, but he has gambling problem. Like, I don't know. Okay. Like, these are the problems of like the ultra wealthy. Right. Like, you're living in a mansion and she can pay the $50,000 for you to open your own casino, but it hurts your pride. Like, that drama, I could really care less about.
And he's just like horrible to hang around with too. Like,
yeah,
there's a scene where he's like, "Is that awful sound coming out of my baby?"
Right. Fuck yourself, dude. Get back on the boat.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I just I think I'm a huge fan of Barbara Streisand without actually being a fan of most of her work, which is such a weird thing to say. But like, I don't know if there like are that many perfect vehicles for what's so great about her.
And I did appreciate that I could hear her singing so much in this film. That was great. And she is such a great comedic performer. So like seeing those musical numbers, honestly, that was the encapsulation of her to me. It was great.
Yeah. And her doing the like kind of vaudevillian shtick in the first half. She's very rapid fire with it. We're like every few breaths, she's like tossing out jokes.
Yeah. She's just an onion roll and a plate of bagels. Do you remember that quote?
Yeah. They don't recognize me.
She's the bagel on a plate.
She's the bagel on a plate of onion rolls.
Oh, yeah. Rolls.
I might have to reverse
she's
that.
She's a bagel because the Jewish.
Right.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I liked her energy a lot when she was really trying to get there. She's just kind of unflappable. And it's so fun to watch her just steamroll over everybody that tries to get in her way or tell her how to do something. And then it's just tragic in the last half that she doesn't have that with him at all. You know, she's kind of overpowered by him.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to fly, I simply got to. If someone takes a spill, it's me and not you. Who told you you're allowed to rain on my parade? At least I didn't fake it, hat, sir. I guess I didn't make it, but whether I'm the rose of sheer perfection or freckle on the nose of life's complexion, the cinder or the shiny apple of its eye, I gotta fly once, I gotta try once, only can die once, right, sir. Ooh, life is juicy, juicy, and you see I'm gonna have my bite. Get ready for me, love, cause I'm a comer. I simply gotta march, my heart's a drummer. Don't bring around a cloud of rain on my parade. I'm gonna live and live now. Get what I want, I know how. One roll for the whole shebang. One throw, that bell will go clang. Eye on the target and wham. One shot, one gunshot.
Next, we're going to talk about an early 70s comedy penned by Buck Henry, in which Barbara Streisand is a wild source of chaos and upends a nerd's marriage proposal, where he has like an uptight fiance, and Barbara Streisand gets naked in that man's bathtub and threatens that marriage. And also you can see her snapping on a carrot like Bugs Bunny. And I'm of course referring to The Owl and the Pussycat from 1970.
It's not the last time she'll have a carrot in her mouth.
Now, all of those qualities are shared by the next two movies on this list, but I'm going to start with the less famous one. The Owl and the Pussycat started as a stage play as well, but it was more of that like kind of off-Broadway weirdo theater kind of vibe. Barbara Streisand plays a sex worker who lives next door to an uptight short fiction writer. And then both of them are failing in New York City and barely scraping by. The guy cannot mind his own business. And when he sees her turning a trick, he calls the landlord and tells on her. She gets evicted in the middle of the night. And as revenge, shows up to his apartment and says, "I'm sleeping here because I'm homeless because of you."
It's perfectly reasonable to
me. And then the rest of the movie is this very acidic rom-com where these two people who are mismatched, both this uptight erudite writer and then this sex worker from the Bronx who has like long nails and wears complicated lingerie and just spouts homophobic slurs every few sentences.
Yeah.
She's basically like a drag queen act waiting to happen. If this movie was more famous, you'd be seeing it more often. But the two of them fall in love against all improbability while going from place to place trying to find somewhere to sleep because they are so mismatched and so feverishly annoyed by each other that they are a noise nuisance that no one can put up with. The movie is annoying. It's at like an 11 the whole time. But I actually kind of like it. The reason I've been wanting to see it for so long is because there's this one photo shoot of Barbara Streisand in leather gear for a fake movie within this movie called Psycho Sluts.
Yes.
I'm sorry, Cycle Sluts.
like biker chick. Yeah.
At one point, the writer that's falling in love with her goes to see this movie in a porno theater, and it's Barbara doing shtick when she's supposed to be sexy in this porno. She's like, oh no, don't chain me up. Oh, you're going to put that in there? Please don't. Like, she's doing this like kind of comedy bit.
It's hilarious.
In the middle of something that's supposed to be sexy. And likewise, she wears like really complicated outfits that are supposed to be sexy, but are really goofy.
That outfit that she has, like her lingerie, where it's like two hands over like her breast, and there's like this like sort of feathery trim.
Yeah.
I've saw a couple of like Etsy listings where like it was like somebody making them like, hey, send me your measurements, you can have this too. Wow. So there has to be drag queens out there doing this performance.
I mean, basically I wanted to see her wear ridiculous like sexy outfits, and the movie delivers on that. She does like a little bit of go-go dancing at a dive bar in like a stripper outfit. She does the S&M porno thing, and then that lingerie with the ridiculous furry piping on the side, and then
with her name on
her butt says Doris. And one of the funniest jokes is he finds her name by reading her butt name, and she says like, who gave you permission to read my panties? Like, every now and then there's a line like that makes you laugh, but also the movie is super grating because these people like hate each other.
I mean, what was that movie we watched recently on Netflix where it was like the two
Fair Play,
we're like just two people arguing for a whole movie. It's like there is something titillating about it where it's like, this is drama, like people fighting, but it grates on you so quickly. And this was another example where like, I guess this is like funny kind of, but man, these people are really annoying.
Right. Well, and part of her character is she's just obnoxiously loud too, and like can't go to sleep without the TV on. She needs constant noise. So she is grating like by default. And then he is awful too. So not only are they arguing, but they are both extremely annoying to listen to.
And it's kind of funny. It's more funny on paper. Mm-hmm. You know, like the idea of these two really annoying star-crossed lovers and everyone around them is like, well, y'all shut the hell up and get out of my apartment.
Right.
Like, that's a funny idea, but when you're actually watching it in real time, you're like, this is annoying. Right. Please this get out of my apartment.
So
like,
unbelievably
I don't want to watch
rude.
You.
They're like the ultimate pests.
Yeah.
There is occasionally like, there is funny stuff in there.
And most of it's like when they're quiet. Like, someone will walk into the room and see him in his Halloween costume and her in her ridiculous lingerie. And there's like a visual gag of like how high-pitched their argument has gotten, stopping abruptly for someone to walk in and be like, okay, I don't know what I just walked into. And like they back out of the room, you know?
How could this have possibly happened?
Right.
Yeah.
There are a few like funny moments like that, and it's like the stabs of quiet in the middle of it.
Yeah.
I just like, I don't picture her doing this style of like porno chic era, like Beyond the Valley of the Dolls sexploitation stuff. And it's so interesting to see her in this context, I think.
Yeah, it's sort of her as like the sex object she always deserved to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, I will talk about it more with another movie, but like this character of her as being this like loud, obnoxious pest is hilarious.
It can be done well. We've seen evidence.
She does it well. Yeah.
I don't even know if there's that much to talk about here. Like, this movie's just a weird curio. I guess the other like news item from it is that they did film a nude scene for this. And she had like final cut on whether or not it would be included.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently High Times magazine leaked the stuff that she said they had to cut out, and she sued them, I think, successfully.
Good for her.
But I think there's just something interesting about seeing her in that context and seeing that aspect of her being like incredibly hot being brought out into the forefront sincerely dealt with.
Yeah, as opposed to like, oh, she is the ugly duckling, which doesn't feel true. Like, this feels more true to like who she actually is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But dialed up to 11. And I do think a lot of why it doesn't work is her like counterpart. I forget the actor's.
George Segal.
George Segal.
Segal. But like, you know, it's just his character. But man, he's just like an annoying dude. He's awful. She's pretty annoying. Two annoying people being annoying.
They deserve each other.
Everyone around them is annoyed. And then the film has like a really strange ending with her playing this like dog.
Yeah, he humiliates her one more time by like making her pretend to be a dog.
I hated that.
Yeah, it was awful.
That was awful. Yeah.
It's supposed to feel bad, and it does. But then they make up.
So that's the point, is that humiliate me one more time.
That's him lashing out, yeah.
Yeah, and I think after he realizes kind of how cruel and weird it was that he asked her to do that, and then kind of changes.
Yeah.
Gross.
Yeah.
I hated it.
He does.
I hated that ending so much.
Segal does play, like, there's a couple of characters, like, in her earlier films that are in, including him, in that film she made in the 90s, The Mirror Has Two Faces. Mm. Like, he kind of comes back into Barbara's film world.
Oh, really?
When they're much older. It's very strange, but kind of fun.
Yeah, this is a strange movie.
It's just weird that it exists.
Yeah.
I almost want to recommend, instead of the movie, just look up the Cycle Sluts photo shoot where she's like posing in different leather outfits.
She's like smiling.
Yeah. She's like, doing shtick in like a sexual environment.
It's very fun.
And it's really fun.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I was kind of hinting at in my intro, like everything that's good about this movie was done better in the next one we're going to talk about.
Oh so God, I picked What's Up, Doc, which was directed by Peter Bogdanovich in 1972. And we watched this the day after we watched The Owl and the Pussycat, and I thought, oh, this is the same movie, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
So
same writer.
Yeah.
Same role.
Yeah. So there are a bunch of different parties gathering for, it's like a research grant competition in San Francisco.
Yes.
So there is a man, Howard Bannister, who's played by Ryan O'Neill, who is a musicologist, and he has a bunch of rocks that make different
his
tones.
Igneous rocks.
Yes, igneous rocks. So the conceit behind this movie is there are all these people coming to this hotel for various reasons, and there are four groups with the same red plaid bag. One bag is owned by Howard Bannister, which has the igneous rocks. The second bag is owned by Judy Maxwell, who's played by Barbara Streisand. It just has a dictionary in her clothes. There's a woman who has a bag filled with precious jewels. And there is a man with a bag filled with government secrets. And the movie revolves around like a shell game that's played with these bags, unbeknownst to the people that own them, in the context of this kind of hotel stay in a screwball comedy.
Like classic, like old Hollywood screwball.
Yeah, I was definitely thinking of Bringing Up Baby the whole time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially because Barbara Streisand, again, plays an agent of absolute chaos. She's like a college hopper. She never finishes her degrees, but she absorbs all
she's
of the material.
She's insanely smart.
Yeah, yeah. So she just she has like an encyclopedic memory. She crosses paths with this man, Howard, who is engaged to a very boring woman named Eunice. That's
Eunice
never
Burns.
A good sign. There's no good Eunices. And Judy just becomes fixated on this man and kind of throws herself into his life and starts to pretend to be his wife at these gatherings for the researchers, and everybody loves her because she's very charming and extremely intelligent, and he is trying to kind of foist her away, but then is also realizing that her presence is great for his career and his chances of getting this research grant. So these bags get all turned around and like result in this climactic gunshot shootout at this very wealthy donor's house, and then Barbara and Ryan O'Neill like escape with all four bags and are being pursued by everybody. I really like screwball comedies, and this was extremely entertaining. I think that Barbara Streisand's chaos was kind of perfectly contained. And I think there was also so much other funny stuff going on that she had a better chance to kind of blend in and fit into a better picture overall.
Yeah.
Also, she gets to sing a little bit here. So I think this movie has a little touch of like all of her really, really fantastic attributes.
I'll go a step further and say that the car chase scene is maybe top three car chase scenes I've ever seen in a movie. It is so...
How many of those are set in San Francisco? Like all of them?
Well, I was also thinking about William Freakin' Jade.
Yeah,
I don't know,
San Francisco.
You're right, during the Chinese New Year festival. Yeah. But man, the use of like the hills.
Yeah.
Just seeing the cars go over the hill. Yeah. And like, you know, the one turnaround...
it's Lombard like the, Street.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Like the big zigzags.
The big zigzag.
Also the classic bit of people carrying a glass pane.
The pane of glass. Like
that was great.
That
stuff.
Like 20 minutes of film, I was ecstatic. Like what I want out of a screwball comedy, like it delivered so much. Like I just had a huge smile on my face for really like the second half of this film. It just like kicked into high gear and I fucking loved it. Like I miss those kind of like it's a mad world those screwball like zany comedies. I don't know if they really make them that much anymore, but like I just like I felt so much joy
and
like with the craziness of it all, like a bunch of crazy characters getting into crazy stuff and it's very funny. And she was great in this.
Yeah, she's doing the full Bugs Bunny.
Right.
Looney Tunes totally.
Thing. I mean, it ends with like, and that's all, folks.
Yeah.
You know, like it is a Looney Tunes cartoon come to life.
Yeah.
And that aspect I loved about this movie.
Like, like this movie is just constantly like at a high the whole time. And like every character is fucking hilarious. Even like side characters that like the bellhop at the hotel that's sort of like connecting with one of the I can't remember like what his role was, but the one of the shorter guys who was like trying to get like a certain bag.
Yeah, he's trying to get the jewels.
The
I
jewels
think.
And like her like over dramatic like my jewels like running through like all these little moments are like so freaking hilarious. And like I have seen this movie so many times. Like this is one of my favorite comedies ever.
Yeah,
but I cry laughing during that like scene where they're in Howard aka Steve's hotel room and she's like on the balcony.
Yeah, that classic bit.
And that's then like great shit's scene. On fire, people are going crazy, and they bring in the roast beef and the sundae, and then she's like looking out the window like, ooh, there's the food I've been trying to order. And like she like pops in and Eunice screams when she sees
and
her. Like,
speaking of like small so characters, funny. Like that Eunice role, Madeline Kahn could have been kind of a throwaway.
Howard?
Yeah.
She's as hilarious. Funny as anybody else in this movie.
All the supporting players, like but Barra especially, like again, the agent of chaos, where I don't know what her motivation really is. Except
she just wanted, she was bored.
She's horny and she's bored. And
he's hot and uptight and she wants to like...
She wanted a roast beef sandwich out of the hotel.
And that's enough. Yeah. Like, that's enough. And it's very entertaining. So to me, this was like... This was my favorite movie that we watched.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And it just like... It scratched that itch of like what Barbara comedically brings to the table. And then it's like... probably the funniest movie we watch and just the most fun out of all of them.
And I think the film was centered around Barbara because I was reading that she wanted to work with Peter Bogdanovich, and so the writer was asking like what kind of movie would you want to make with her, and he was like, oh well, it'd be a comedy, you know. So I wonder if he saw The Owl and the Pussycat.
Maybe
it
beforehand.
Seems like a lot of bleed over, and Buck Henry wrote both movies, so you know. It is funny, like, I watched the library DVD had, like, two commentary tracks, and one is Peter Bogdanovich doing this very, like, serious academic rundown of, like, where every idea came from. He's talking about Cary Grant and bringing up Baby. He's talking about the Looney Tunes and, like, all this, like, basically, like, laying out the influences and, like, what he was thinking for every scene. And then there's a commentary track from Barbara Streisand on it. And it is 12 minutes long instead of the entire length of the movie.
Oh, my God.
And it's mostly the downhill chase scene. And she just goes, oh, God. Oh, could you imagine? Oh, look at that. Oh, wow.
Yes. We texted about this, like, because I have the DVD and I was watching it. And I couldn't stop laughing. And she's like, well, everyone's talking about these top secret papers the first time I'm seeing them. And I was in the film. Yeah. Like, it's just her, like, oh, wow. Would you look at that? Oh, wow. God. Could you imagine?
Oh, I remember that.
Oh,
wow.
God. Oh, my God.
The car stuff so is legitimately, like, seems dangerous.
Yeah.
Really, like,
could
wow.
you imagine?
Could you imagine? I felt that way. Like, man, somebody has to get hurt during, like,
yeah.
And I think, like, didn't an actor almost drown the scene where the cars go car into yeah. the, yeah. like, one of the actors,
stunt actor, maybe?
Yeah, it's yeah. just like, yeah, that shit was wild.
Yeah, the delivery bike, like, I guess, like, there's yeah. the car chase, but also in that same sort of realm of the movie, the three-wheel delivery bike stuff,
yeah.
like,
yeah.
going under oh the, my like, God. Dragon.
Yeah. And, like, yeah, swooping the dragon away. Just the image of that dragon so quickly leaving.
So
but
funny.
Even, like, with the pane of glass, like, how close
yeah,
the cars
so
were
good.
Coming
yeah.
to the actors, yeah. like, within a foot. I'm like, dude, yeah. I don't know. Like, what
yeah.
the safety protocols, wherever. This is wild.
This does feel like a little more ramshackle than something like Funny Girl. Like, there is, like,
yeah,
it is just as much embedded in that old Hollywood storytelling style. But unlike Funny Girl, just feels like the tail end of that. And this feels like a someone who grew up watching that stuff making, like, a newer, edgier version of it. And, like, yeah, it does yeah. feel genuinely dangerous in, like, a Friedkin kind of way. And it feels looser and a little, like, amoral to the point where it plays, like, homage instead of, like, the end of an era. Hmm. And it was just a few years later.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, like, too, like, with Funny Girl, though, like, it's a musical movie. And, like, a lot of musical movies all follow that same pattern. So, I don't know, maybe it being a musical movie was maybe holding it back.
In its time, Hollywood made great, quick, light on their feet musicals.
Musical films?
They just got a little bloated by the 60s.
Okay.
Maybe we should do like a 40s musical episode.
Yeah, that'd be great.
It can be done well. I've seen yeah. it done. And we have talked about Barbara Streisand directing movies before in the show. We did Yentl, yep. which is a fantastic film.
Wonderful movie.
But she did transition from starring in these things to actually like making them herself. And that's what our final selection today is, another one from that filmography.
Which she did direct. She also co-produced. She starred in. So this is very much Barbara Streisand's. This is the whole deal.
Yeah.
She had
yeah,
full creative
vision.
Control.
A tour.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Barbara.
And it's from, I believe, 1991, called The Prince of Tides. A movie that I grew up on because my mom owned this movie and I remember watching it numerous times. It was nominated for Oscars. It was nominated for Best Picture and it didn't win anything, but
shame.
Yeah.
Prestige.
Yeah, this is prestige stuff. It's adapted from a book from 1986. It stars Nick Nolte as Tom, who is a teacher / football coach who is summoned by his mother up to New York to basically, his sister has had a suicide attempt and her psychiatrist, played by Barbara Streisand, wants to know a little bit more about their family life and what actually is leading, you know, this family trauma that's leading to these suicide attempts. And she wants to get that information through him. And so he goes up to New York from South Carolina. And they, you know, initially start as like a client sort of relationship, but then he is asked to coach her son in football in a strange, I guess it's in the book, it's strange yeah. in the movie.
He wants to play football, but he can't when his dad is around.
It's like the yeah. opposite because his dad's like,
violinist.
His dad's
right.
a very
yeah.
famous violinist. He wants his son to be in the violin, but his son wants to play football.
Great villain, that guy.
Yeah. Oh, great. And we'll get to that. We'll get to that. But so he's like helping her son learn football.
Which, her son is so bad at football.
He's bad at football.
He looks like Kyle Mooney.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
And you can't learn football in like 2 weeks.
Like he, Nick Nolte throws the football at him and he just doesn't react. It's just like why, what part of you wants to play football? Have you not
I
ever played?
Well, I think it's the part that wants to piss off his parents.
Yeah.
He's a little brat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, while this is going on, Nick Nolte, Tom is opening up to her and they start to form a relationship. And there is a lot of fucked up stuff in his family's history. And he starts, you know, he has this old Southern way of like, oh, we just laugh about it. We don't like cry about trauma or the pain. And Barbara kind of helps him open up. And he eventually like reveals some really dark secrets to her and cries in front of her. And they start a romantic relationship.
She heals him.
Right. So first of all, well, the ethics of that are kind of murky, right? I mean, a psychiatrist falling in love with a patient through their opening up of their trauma.
They try to distance it a little bit. It's like not actually her patient.
Right, but it's also really fucked up to sleep with the brother of your patient while she is kind of in and out of consciousness. Ward. Yeah.
But so this film is very, it's very melodramatic, which I actually like the strong, like strings pulling at you emotionally. It's very like a lot of big, like tearjerker kind of moments. I thought that Nick Nolte was fantastic in this. It's really playing this like, you know, guy that's trying to cover up his trauma with just jokes and all that. But ultimately, I thought this was like a really bad, really bad movie. And I thought that like Barbara Streisand's directing was a big problem. There's two scenes I want to talk about that I think really exemplify my problem with her as a director in this is that the big one is the grand reveal of what actually happened to them as kids. And it's this really awful rape scene where these three convicts break in and they rape Nick Nolte and his twin sister and, you know, his other brother.
Or his mother.
Oh, and his mother, sorry. And that is like the emotional catharsis of the whole movie, right? It's like, it's been building up to that. Nick Nolte finally like revealing what is this trauma. And instead, and this is a director's choice, instead of focusing on him, the actor, revealing this, and like we as the audience were like in it with him, she does this thing where she does these like flashbacks where as he's retelling the story of the rape, we go back to these really awful images of like the rape happening in real time with like pants being pulled down. And
it goes there.
It goes there. But it does a disservice to Nick Nolte in his performance where like she's not trusting the actor to give you that information. We got to go back to this really tawdry, like show it to really get, you know, to
like
really
versus him just like talking about it.
And I would have loved it so much because he really gives it his all in this performance. I would have loved it so much more if he trusted him as an actor to just like tell it instead of showing it. So that really bothered me. And there was another scene right after the transition from the rape reveal to a shot of a football being passed into the, like, there were some choices with the shots. You just said this like really emotional, like I'm on the edge of tears. Like he finally opened up, he's crying. And then it slow segues into a shot of a football in the breeze. Going
after that reveal, the movie has nothing to do for the next 20 minutes.
Right. And that goes to a third problem I have with the movie is
the
that
list is getting longer
because the original book was apparently a lot more about his trauma, which I think is what the movie is about. But I have a suspicion that because Barbara Streisand was involved and starring in it, wanted to make the role of the psychiatrist a bigger one.
The almighty Lowenstein.
Lowenstein. Which
it, Lowenstein.
Lowenstein. And she couldn't help herself to inject more of her into the story. Yeah. And I think the book, the relationship with the psychiatrist is kind of an afterthought. It's like a little bit of the story, but the real story is like the flashbacks to their childhood and his brother. But the whole second half of this movie is the relationship stuff. And that feels injected because she has to be a centerpiece of this film.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. But it does a disservice to what the movie is actually about, because to me, Nick Nolte is great in this. He really carries a lot of the emotional weight. But when it transitions to the relationship stuff and it becomes mm-hmm. about Lowenstein,
yeah,
it totally lost me and felt kind of like a vanity project. And I think it's a really disjointed mess of a movie.
So Streisand likes Streisand. Like she,
yeah.
And I like her. So I'm like, great. I like Lowenstein. But do you think that like, that sort of second half where he explores that relationship with her, but I almost feel like his relationship that he had with Lowenstein, like made him want to, like when he's like, I can't do this. Like I have a family and I want to go back to them. Like that saved his marriage.
Well,
a little bit. But, like,
but here's another, my last problem. I have a whole laundry list.
It's gone from 2 to 4.
Right, I know. But the other thing is like with the infidelity aspect and the morality of infidelity.
Right.
It's like her husband in this is so god awful.
Yeah.
He's hilarious.
He's hilarious. But he's a total he's a snob. Villain. When the rest of the movie is so like based in like very human people mm-hmm. and like he is playing a villain out of like a some other movie,
insanely rude.
But he
corners Nick Nolte at a party and plays the dueling banjo song and the fiddle in his face and is making mocking faces.
It's so embarrassing for him.
Right, but it's very funny. But it's
he
like
takes
of
the
a,
violin
it's like
as
out
ransom.
Of a different movie.
Yeah,
and it's like it like, but to the point of like the morality of it, it's like. For her to cheat on her husband, he has to be an awful person.
Right, right.
We can't have this, like, you know, there's been a lot of, like, what Bridges of Madison County
mm-hmm.
or, like, was it Past Lives or...
Yeah, I
to
mean...
some degree, like,
but,
the complexity of, like, infidelity and how that happens in this movie...
Right, or, like, Brief Encounter.
Brief Encounter, too, is a great example. Yeah. This movie cannot do that. It can't deal with complexity... For you to cheat on your partner, they have to be awful or they have to have already cheated on you.
It's a little complicated. My problem with it is more like Lowenstein just makes him a better man and a better husband. And like that's her service in the movie. And then she
kind of understands that, too.
Yeah, like, that's the part that saves it, like, is they talk about it. Like, there's a lot of like actual discussion of those dynamics. And it's not just happening in these like as these like narrative cliches. Like it's actually like. Real people having these adult conversations about it. So that saves it a little bit.
I don't think it's a real person thing to like, at the end of the movie, he says he drives over the bridge home and whispers her name.
Lowenstein.
Like every day. That's insane.
Oh, that is weird.
That's not a brief encounter. Right.
You will carry this person with you forever.
Also, the movie starts on the phoniest note, which is him like doing his... Where I was growing up, we used to go underwater and
it
tell all our
simple.
Secrets.
love that show. I actually did like living.
I like that.
I like that stuff.
And that's where tomatoes a little bit.
Right.
Yeah, I like the South Carolina boy.
I like to compare the first and the last scene. A lot of people make it a concise, like that kind of tells the story of the movie. The first scene is very much centered around... his childhood. You get hints that there was unhappiness and violence and you don't understand it, and that this group of siblings has weathered this storm together somehow. Mm-hmm. That's the first scene.
That's the heart of the actual story.
Yeah, the last scene is him with his happy family, you know, and all of that is because of his ability to process everything. But the last line is him whispering Lowenstein's name. Like, that to me is not a satisfying arc for the narrative of the film.
Right, he comes to grips with this trauma two-thirds of the way through, and then it's just them going on a romp, like a sex trip to a cabin where they can just have sex a bunch of times, and then he has to go back to his family. But he learned a lot about his trauma.
And also him like stressing to her that he loved her just as much as his wife. He just loved his wife longer. And I mean, I know, again, we're a movie podcast, not a book podcast. This doesn't have to mirror the book, but the book is like he has a relationship with her and realizes he loves her, his wife. Lowenstein like divorces her husband and starts dating someone else.
Juicy.
Yeah, like they both realize we're in these situations that don't serve us. And so then like she helps him, but he also helps her. And we don't really get that closure for her in the movie. And he's also weirdly still attached to her in the film in a way that he's not in the book.
In the movie, it almost seems like that her payoff is almost that she has a better relationship with her son.
Yeah.
Is like what he kind of did for her a little bit. Yeah. Like he's not, you know, bitching.
She's got to get a divorce, though.
The football stuff is so silly.
Like, it's like the baseball and Night Swim. Like, why is this so much about baseball?
Right. Why? And apparently, I was like, I thought that was just injected into the film, no, but that's apparently that's in the book.
Yeah.
But like,
I never read the book, y'all.
Is like, he knows nothing about football. He's like, I want to play football. And then what, within a couple months, he like right. is good at football? I don't think
he goes from Nolte is supposed like to be this like fantastic coach. Yeah.
Maybe like, just teaches him discipline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole thing about the football is just to make his dad mad, because obviously that guy would hate football. He's such like a snob.
I don't know. Yeah. It seemed like he liked football.
Because isn't he like, oh, you're going to ruin your hands.
Yeah.
You'll never be able to play the violin.
You know, I think it's really short shrift as the sister. Like this whole dramatic scenario is about this woman who almost died by suicide. And like they talk about her. They discuss her poetry and her trauma and stuff. Was she on screen maybe like a minute?
And then, well, and then the end of the movie, she's like out and she's like, I'm feeling good.
Yeah, but apparently
the book really delved more into like the relationship with the siblings, which I wanted more out of the movie. But again, I think because Streisand was involved, I need to have a bigger part. And that part is the love relationship with him and the psychiatrist. And that does a disservice to the actual story that should have been told.
Sounds like we all need to find a copy of the DVD and the commentary from Streisand to understand her choices.
I will say the disc I picked up was Criterion. It was like a Criterion DVD from the library.
What?
I was very surprised by it.
Really?
Yeah.
And it did have some interviews on the second disc. I did not watch the commentary track.
Yeah.
I didn't know that this was available at the public library.
New Orleans Public Library,
That would be interesting, because there were a lot of pretty significant changes from the book. Like the ages of the children when the rape happens.
Uh-huh.
In the movie, Tom does not kill his assailant, and that's a big part of his story. Oh. And in the book, he does.
Oh.
Also in the book, they're 18, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Oh.
So she made it more sensational by like lowering the ages.
Yeah, and the brother character, he features in the movie a lot, but his death is like a huge part of the book and is a huge part of the brother and the sister processing their trauma. I think the rape is held up as the big climactic moment in the movie, and it seemed like it wasn't so much in the book. Like there was all of this text about the family and about the family coming to grips, the children coming to grips with the parents and talking to them, that was just kind of left out. And I really loved all of that stuff.
I kind of bought into the like Southern charm of like burying your secrets too. I know the rape scene stuff, the flashback didn't work for you, but like the flashback right after that where the mother makes them clean up frantically in that like mommy dearest kind of way to remove all evidence, like I found that really shocking. And like the mother's sort of like complete brain wipe where she just like won't accept that that even happened.
Well, that happened, but we're gonna move
and then she like
that.
Brings it up again too, where she's like, what did you tell, like she's like, nobody better tell shit about this, like
it was also a huge jump scare for me. Like they have a very abusive father figure,
yeah,
and then like about three quarters in the movie it's revealed that that guy's still alive and just like
they're
working
just
on a shrimp boat
together.
Right. That's what
shocked me.
Like, what are you?
But I think that's realistic. Like, a lot of times when people come from families like that, it's like, well,
that's
you
just
know,
how he is.
You
just never going to change.
And he's not like that anymore. He's
not,
a nice
not to get into any
man.
Like personal stuff, but like that idea that, oh, And there's even a line towards the end of the movie, something to the effect of like, you know, oh yeah, you know, they're my parents are complicated or whatever, but you gotta love them, you know, because they're your parents. It's like, yeah, fuck that. If your dad beat the shit out of you and did the things that their father did in this movie, why do you need them in your life at all?
I struggle with that with my family all the time.
I know. Well, that's what I said. I didn't want to get personal.
And they
are
very forgiving to people who've done very fucked up shit. Yeah. It's like, that's my brother. That's my cousin.
Fuck
it's
that.
It's this idea of blood.
Idea at all.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it causes rifts because I have to like section off parts of my family I don't talk to anymore because that person's still in their life and I don't want to interact
with
them.
But when the Tom character's like bringing his kids like, oh yeah, grandpa, you know, the shrimp boat guy, like, my grandpa God. Sucks.
Yeah.
Leave grandpa to die alone. Yeah. Like, you don't
normally
need to
they're nice
kids
to the
like,
grandkids,
right.
though, after they get the shit out
right.
of
that's what I was going to say. Yeah. Like, when you have a family like that, you know, it's like family is a big part of the tradition of life, having a grandfather. And if your grandfather can take your children out on a shrimp boat and he's not going to beat them if he's not an alcoholic anymore, like, and they never have to see that, I can understand how someone would still keep them in their life.
Well, and that felt very real to me. Like, real, true to life. I don't know.
Well, and the same with his mother. Yeah. You know, like, they have a contentious relationship, but he still goes to see his mom.
Yeah.
You know, but again, like, that, all that stuff, the familial relationship stuff, was interesting, and Nick Nolte carried a lot of that weight with his performance. I just don't know if what Barbra Streisand's psychiatrist character really added to this movie. I would have like really enjoyed it if she was in it far less.
Yeah,
than she
I didn't need the cabin scene.
I didn't need the
Streisand in that like psychiatrist setting is very campy to me in like a way
when
that like
throws
I really
the,
enjoyed
the book at him. The
that was
she,
funny.
That was funny.
Yeah. Also, just her just doing psychiatrist talk like on. What
explore
does
that,
feel that like
a little
for
more.
You?
Tell me.
Yeah. I'm watching Sopranos for the first time right now, and that's definitely Lorraine Bracco's like role in that show too.
Yeah.
Same outfit, same color palette. Yeah. It is interesting watching her do a dramatic role because everything else we talked about was like pure comedy.
Yeah, it's true.
And it does take her sensuality and her like attractiveness seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really question whether she's like funny looking. You know,
I felt the attraction between her and Nick Nolte. Like, there's a lot of funny scenes where they're like out at a party and he's hovering like within inches.
That was
her neck.
Right. Yeah, the scene where they're at the dinner party and her husband is playing violin and they're both watching and Nick Nolte is right behind her.
Right.
Like, are y'all fucking right now?
Right, yeah, it looks like you are.
So I will say, like, if you want to get a taste of, like, Barbra at her peak being a director, have you watched Yentl?
I have not.
Yentl's a classic.
Yentl's so
good. It's very good.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's hot, too.
Yeah,
there's a lot
is.
Of, like, gender play between her and
Mandy Patinkin.
Mandy Patinkin.
Yeah. Okay.
It's very good.
I need to
he's,
see
like,
that.
He's, like, attracted to her but doesn't know that she's a woman and then, like, uses her as like a sexual surrogate to have sex with this other person that he's attracted to. There's some like really hot like play between the sexual characters in the
really
movie.
Good.
That sounds good. This felt like very Oscar baity.
Yeah. Didn't win her one.
Didn't win one.
Well, I think the selections that we chose, I think, really show like there's a lot of films out there that she's done, a lot of work she's done, but
Babalooza Part 2 next summer.
I know. Exactly what I'm thinking. because we didn't even talk about one of her greatest films of all time, which is The Way We Were with Robert Redford. Iconic.
Referenced on several episodes of Sex and the City. So I feel like I should see
it. Yeah, we'll have to revisit that. And then we could throw in Hello, Dolly, Walter Matthau. but like starting with like where she started on screen, which is, you know, Funny Girl, kicks off her career. She's this powerhouse. And then she becomes this Hollywood Funny Girl.
Right.
And then she starts to lean into these dramatic roles, right? Like Prince of Tides, Your Mirror Has Two Faces. And I think like where she's at now, she's, you know, last couple movies she did was like The Guilt Trip or
with Seth Rogen.
Yeah, like Meet the Fockers. Like she's still hilarious.
Having fun
Yeah, she's in her fun stage of life.
I did like her in Meet the Fockers.
She's fabulous. Great.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't know if she plans on acting in anything anytime soon. She's like 81 years old, but she is coming out with like new music this year. So she's still active.
That's most of my relationship with her is like, every thrift store I've ever been to has several Barbra Streisand records waiting to go home with you. And yeah, I don't even know if I've loved any of the ones I've bought. Like, it's usually for like a buck. But like, I just love listening to her voice.
Yeah.
And that's how I feel about the movies too. Like, I might love her voice, but not love the song. And I might love her screen presence, but not love the movie she's in.
Totally. Fair. She I really has a very strong magnetic presence.
Yeah.
And I think I was initially bothered by how kind of egocentric the films felt. Like, they all felt like they were just, Barbra Streisand is amazing and look at how amazing she is. But
can't argue with that.
No, you can't argue with that. And I kept wanting to watch her, so yeah.
Don't you just think movies when you hear that music, huh? As a kid, I loved the movies. They meant so much to me. They took me to another place where I could imagine myself as someone else, somewhere else. They really did help shape my dreams. You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply. Time.